Hi, this is Bob Miles. Over the years, much has been written and said about John Lennon. Most accounts relate his beginnings as a member of the Beatles and his somewhat offbeat lifestyle. On these sides, you'll hear in his own voice the feelings, observations, and real truth about himself, his wife Yoko, his music, and his lifestyle. What is most incredible is that this interview took place only hours before his death. It was recorded on December 8, 1980, about 12 hours before the shooting. The setting is an office in his New York record label, Geffen Records. John and Yoko began with a discussion of their recently completed Double Fantasy album.
I was possessed by this rock and roll devil, you know. Suddenly I got the songs, you know. Just suddenly Ziggy Stardust now would be called Tommy. And then you would call it a rock opera, you see? But we always worked from our own selves as near as we could. So the album, the work we did on this thing is really a play. But we're using ourselves as the characters. And what we sing about in the record and the songs are real diaries of how we feel. But also it's always not really, really real because it's a song and it's on a record and you project it in a different way. We had discussed going back in the studio, but I didn't have the material, but I wasn't worried about it because I thought, well, I haven't done it for a long time. If I switch into that, there'll be something there. But it just sort of came. And I called her because I was in Bermuda with Sean, and she was here in New York. I called her and I said, well, look, we were talking about recording. It must have triggered something off here because I'm getting all this stuff. And I started singing it to her down the phone or playing a cassette. And she would call back 2 hours later and say, well, when you sang that, Losing You, she'd come back with Moving On or something. And then I'd say, oh, Moving On, okay. And then I'd be swimming or doing anything. Suddenly something else would come, like starting over. I'd say, hey, well, look, this is what happened. And it started working, like, coming out like that. So then I couldn't wait to get back and start then. I suddenly had all this material. After not really trying, but not trying either for 5 years. I'd been so locked in the home environment and completely switched my way of thinking that I didn't really think about music at all. My guitar was sort of hung up on behind the bed, literally. And don't think I took it down in 5 years. It inspired me completely. As soon as she would sing something to me or play the cassette down the phone, within 10 or 15 minutes, whether I wanted to work or not, if you call it work, I would suddenly get this song coming to me. And I always felt that the best songs were ones that came to you rather than... I do have the ability to, you know, if you ask me to write a song for a movie or something and they say it's about this, I can sit down and sort of make a song. I wouldn't be thrilled with it, but I can make a song like that. But I find it difficult to do that, but I can do it. You know, I call it craftsmanship, you know. I've had enough years at it to sort of put something together, but I never enjoyed that. I like it to be inspirational from the spirit. And being with Sean and switching off from the business sort of allowed that channel to be free for a bit. You know, it wasn't always on. It was switched off, and when I sort of switched it on again, zap, all this stuff came through. So now we're already... we did half enough material for the next album, almost half as much. And we're already talking about the third album, so we're full of
vim and vigor.
Sometimes you think, wow, yeah, great. This is great. We've done it. And then the next time you hear it, well, she's not quite the same as Al. Think, no, this is not right. It's not right. Yeah. So I would go yay and nay on it all the time. But I think basically we thought listen to it for what it is and not listen to it with preconceived ideas of how it ought to be or as compared to something else, then if people could listen to it just as if it wasn't even John and Yoko, just that it came over the radio and you accept it or not accept it as you hear it, not as you expect to hear John Lennon or expect to hear Yoko Ono or expect to hear an ex-Beatle or expect to hear whatever, or having read a good review or a bad review, forget about that. Just get it on the radio, I thought, and it'll be all right. I was taking Sean and the nanny and the family to a little, except for mother, who was here selling cows, in Bermuda to the Botanical Gardens for lunch, to the Italian restaurant, because I could get espresso and Sean could get some junk food. And I was just walking in, I looked down, and it was a botanical garden, and it said, we're in the office, folks, that's why it's buzzing. It said, Freesia, Double Fantasy. And it was some flowers. And I just thought, Double Fantasy, that's a great title. Because it has so many meanings that you couldn't even begin to think what it means. So it means everything you can think of. I mean, it's a double couple. It's real life, but it's still a fantasy because it's now in plastic and in photograph. And it's fantastic. And it's just it sort of seemed to be perfect for a title of the album. And there's two of us. And it just sort of says it all somehow without really saying anything. It says everything. And it's a flower, actually.
The discussion now takes a turn from the artist John Lennon to the man and daddy John Lennon. Indeed, during the late 70s, John had all but forsaken his music to concentrate on being a husband and father.
Even as I put it in my last incarnation, everybody's got something to hide except for me and my monkey. It means really that, you know, one cannot be absolutely oneself in public because the fact that you're in public makes you have to have some kind of defense or whatever it is. But we always tried from, whether it's from Two Virgins through Imagine, through anything we've done together, the films we made together, always tried to get as near to the uncensored, as it were, for what we are, not to project an image of something that we're not. Because having been in that sort of pop business so long, and tried to retain myself throughout it, but obviously not always being successful at that, it was most uncomfortable when I didn't feel I was being myself. You know, when I would have to smile when I didn't want to smile. And it became like all that, like being a politician, you know. And what I really got through this 5 years is I'm not running for office. I like to be liked. I don't like to offend people. I would like to be a happy, contented person. I don't want to have to sell my soul again, as it were, to have a hit record. I've discovered that I can live without it, and it makes it happier for me. But I'm not going to come back in and try and create a persona who would not be myself. He was born on October the 9th, which I was, so we're almost like twins. You know, the funny thing, if he doesn't see me a few days, or if I'm really, really busy, you know, and I just sort of get a glimpse of him, or if I'm feeling depressed, without him even seeing me, he sort of picks up on it, and he starts getting that way. So it's like I can no longer afford to have artistic depressions, which usually produced a miserable song, but it was something I could use, you know. So if I start going really deep, sort of wallowing in a depression, I kind of enjoy it or whatever one does with them, the best you can, he'll start coming down with stuff, you know, so I'm sort of obligated to keep up. But sometimes I can't because something will make me depressed and there's no way I can deal with it. And then he's sure as hell he'll get a cold or come or trap his finger in the door or something will happen, you know, and so now I have a sort of more reason to stay healthy and bright. I cannot no longer wallow in it and say, well, this is how artists are supposed to be, I suppose, you know, make them write the blues, you know. Mm-hmm. A boy was really programmed to go in the army, that was about it, you know. And you had to be tough and you're not supposed to cry and you're not supposed to show emotion. And I know Americans show more emotion and more open than English people, but it's pretty similar over here. There's that Calvinist, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon ethic, which is don't touch, don't react, don't feel. And I think that's what screwed us all up. And I think it's time for a change. I took the time. Any famous star or whatever it is where you come under, and I'm not going to name any names, but many of them that had problems with their kids, you know, either killing themselves or in various ways. I don't buy that bit about, you know, quality over quantity. You know, like an hour a week of intense rolling in the hay together is better than, you know, 20 minutes every day of you being bitchy and just being yourself around him. So I don't try and be the God Almighty kind of figure that never is always smiling and such this wonderful father. I'm not putting out an image of this person who knows all about. Nobody knows about children. That's the thing. You look in the books, there's no real experts. Everybody's got a different opinion. You learn by default, in a way. And I made a lot of mistakes already, but what can you do? But I think it's better for him to see me as I am. If I'm grumpy, I'm grumpy. If I'm not, I'm not. If I want to play, I'll play. If I don't, I don't. I don't kowtow to him. I'm straight with him as I can be. And yes, I can afford to take the time. But anybody with a working wife might be able to afford to take the time if they're not really not a working wife because they're poor and they both have to work. But I know lots of dads who aren't working that hard, who are just sitting in an office all day anyway to avoid life, you know. I mean, they're sitting behind desks and they're doing nothing, just shuffling paper, right, waiting for lunchtime to get a cocktail. But I don't buy that, you know, my career is so important that I'll deal with the kids later, bit, which I already did with my first marriage, my first child, and I kind of regret it. My other son by my first marriage is 17. I don't remember seeing him as a child. It didn't even enter, like most guys are 24, 25, they're too intent on their career, really. Well, Yoko was a poor artist when I met her, okay? And living in not the best conditions, and she had a child, and the child went wherever she went. She took her on stage, you know, I mean, a little squirking thing on the... And she would take her when they were making movies, because I saw, before we got together, I've seen her work and the way she worked, and the Kyoko was running around all over the place. And there are many artistically inclined people that have worked like that in the past, not since the 60s, but in the 30s and any other time. So even if I was poor, it's the state of mind I'm in. I would work out some way for him to be around us somehow, okay? I would have chosen my career to suit that. You don't have to be rich to love your kids. I learned a lot from the child, because they're not hypocrites and they're not phony, and they know when you're put... he knows already, you know. I mean, already he makes me feel... You know, anybody with a child that spent any moment with them, you know, and it's good for you, I think, because one does tend to fool oneself and the kids don't buy it. Because I hadn't been in the studio for 5 years or whatever, so he's used to me being around all the time. Because it's a pleasure for me to hang around the house. I was always a homebody. I mean, I think a lot of musicians are, you know, you write and you play in the house anyway. Or as when I was wanting to be a painter when I was younger, I was all in the house, or write poetry, it was always in the house. But I started the work, you know, and he started seeing a bit less of me. I'd let him come to the studio, but it was a bit boring. He was excited, but long story short, at the end of the session, and it was going on, I got back on a night schedule where I'd be coming in when he'd be getting up, so he'd see me at breakfast, but I was a sort of shredded, okay, what, like that. And then one day we were sort of lying down on the bed together, so I'm maybe watching some cartoon or whatever, and he just sat up and said, you know what I want to be when I grow up? I said, no, what's that? He looked me right in the eye and said, just a daddy. And I thought, mm-hmm. I said, you mean you don't like it that I'm working now, right? I'm going out a lot. He says, right. I said, well, I'll tell you something, Sean. It makes me happy to do the music. I might have more fun with you if I'm happier, right? He said, mm-hmm.
John was about 15 and Paul McCartney 13 years old when they first met. John talked about meeting McCartney for the first time and knowing almost immediately that this was the man he wanted for a partner.
I was saying to somebody the other day, there's only two artists I've ever worked with for more than one night stand, as it were. That's Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono. I think that's a pretty damn good choice. Because in the history of the Beatles, Paul met me the first day I did Bebopalula live on stage. Okay? And a mutual friend brought him to see my group called the Quarrymen. And we met and we talked after the show. And I saw he had talent and he was playing guitar backstage and doing 20 Flight Rock by Eddie Cochran. And I turned around to him right then on first meeting and said, do you want to join the group? And he said, And I think he said yes the next day, as I recall it. Now, George came through Paul. And Ringo came through George, although, of course, I had a say in where they came from. But the person I actually picked as my partner, who I recognized had talent and I could get on with, was Paul. Now, 12, well, however many years later, I met Yoko. I had the same feeling. It was a different field, but I had the same feeling. So I think as a talent scout, I've done pretty damn well.
As dramatic as the meeting with Paul McCartney was, it was another encounter that would radically change John Lennon's outlook on life. It was 1966 at a gallery in London. John was about to meet a young artist named Yoko Ono, and he would also be coming to terms with her unusual artworks, something for which his boyhood years in Liverpool had not prepared him.
It was sort of 1966, and I got a call from a guy called John Dunbar, who used to be married to Marion Faithfull. You know, everybody's connected. And he had a gallery in London called Indica Gallery, an art gallery. And I used to go there occasionally to see whatever art show was on, you see. And he said, oh, I've got this, there's this fantastic Japanese girl coming from New York, and she's going to do this other thing, but she's also going to put on an exhibition at my gallery. And it's going to be this big event, and something about black bags. And I thought, ooh, orgies, you know. you know, these artists, they're all ravers. You know, it was in the days of happenings and paint and all that stuff, right? So I go right down there, you know, for the opening. Goody, goody, you know. You know, goes down, see what's happening. I get down there, and it's the night before the opening. I thought there was going to be a big party and an opening and the whole bit, you know, a big hat. I didn't want to get involved. I wanted to watch, you know. I get there, it's all white and quiet, and there's just these strange things all on display, like an apple on a stand for £200, when the pound was worth $8 or something, or whatever. And there's hammers with insane hammering in, all this very peculiar stuff, and a ladder with a painting on the sky. Or it looked like a blank canvas on the ceiling with a spyglass hanging from it. So I'm looking around, and there doesn't seem to be many people. There's a couple of people downstairs, and I didn't know who was who. So I get up the ladder, and I look through this spyglass, and it said, yes. And I took that as a personal positive message, because most of the avant-garde artists of that period were all negative, you know, like break a piano with an axe. It was mainly male. I'm looking at the female here. It was mainly male art, and it was all destructive and, you know. But here was this little crazy message on the ceiling. And then the guy introduced me to her, and she didn't know who the hell I was. She had no idea. You know? She was living in a different environment altogether. And I was saying, well, I thought, this is a good con, isn't it? Apples for £200 and hammer and nail. Who's going to buy this? You know, I didn't know what concept art was, which in a nutshell is the idea is more important than the object. So that's why you won't see many rich concept artists around, because you can't really, you know, like the guy that wraps up that, what's the guy that wraps up the
crystal
wraps up things. Well, he doesn't expect you to buy the canvas. What he's doing is selling you this idea, whatever it is he's projecting. It was the same kind of thing, but I hadn't come across it before. I said, how do you sell a nail and a hammer, you know? So anyway, the gallery owner was all fussing around. He was thinking, well, is he going to buy something? And she's ignoring me, you know. So he introduced us, and I said, well, where's the event, you know, where's the happening? Because I'd seen the bag. So she just takes a card out and gives it to me and just says, breathe. So I said, you mean that? She said, you got it. I said, uh-huh, all right, I'm beginning to catch on here. So I see the hammer hanging on the thing with a few nails in it. I said, well, can I at least hammer a nail in? You know, I've come all the way from the suburbs for this. And she says, no. So anyway, the gallery owner has a little word with her, and she says, she comes over and she says, all right, no smiling or anything, because you know how she is. She's not running for office. She never was, so she looks at me and she says, you give me 5 shillings. Give me 5 shillings and you can hammer a nail in. So I looked at her and I said, I'll give you an imaginary 5 shillings and hammer an imaginary nail in, okay? And that's when we connected really, and we looked at each other like, you know, that sort of, something went on. Well, I didn't see her again for a few weeks. We went to a Klaus Oldenburg opening, and I went with Paul, and I don't know who she was with, but I got separated from Paul, and I felt this sort of vibe behind me. And I looked around, and there she was, you know. And we're both very shy, believe it or not. And I don't know what I said. We said something. We didn't really get together till 18 months later. We didn't make love till 2 years. We knew. You think we're rock and rollers, you know,
yeah.
All the life that people lead. I really, really needed to be with her, wanted to be with her, and could not literally survive without her as a functioning human being. I just went to pieces, and I didn't realize that I needed her so much. I needed her more than she needed me, and I've always thought the boot was on the other foot. You know, and that's as honest as I can get. And the image is always, because the pop star, and Burt Reynolds said it, and God bless him, that he's the women have always kicked him out. And Yoko kicked me out. I didn't go off on I'm going to be a rock and roll bachelor. She literally said, get out. You know, and I said, okay, I'm going. You know, I've got a bachelor of three. I'd been married all my life. You know, I'd been married before Yoko, and I immediately married Yoko, so I'd never been a bachelor since I was 20 or something. So I thought, it was god-awful. And the other thing I want to say about Burt Reynolds, Barbara Walters asked him, what do you want to be remembered as? And he said, the best father that ever was, yeah. And I thought, thank God, you know, I began to feel maybe I'm the only father that's interested in relating, and is it going to become, oh, John Lennon's now selling this family business, and he's been through peace and love, and now he's coming on like daddy, and all that, and I'm only talking about it because that's what I've done, and that's how I feel, and admitting that it is that I'm more feminist now than I was when I sang Woman is the Nigger. I was intellectually a feminist then, but now I feel as though at least I've put my body where my mouth was, and tried to really live up to my own preachings, as it were. And to see somebody like Burt Reynolds, who is the world's number one male star over all the pop stars worldwide, to have the guts to say he wants to be known as a father, I thought, oh great, I'm not going to be alone on this one.
Almost from the start, John and Yoko experimented with sound as art, staying up all night, howling and making strange noises into a tape recorder. The resulting collage of unusual sounds went into an album called Two Virgins. Some of the recording techniques they used, as well as public reaction to the nude photos on the cover of that album, are what we hear next.
I used to have a place where I worked in the house again, upstairs, in my first incarnation with my other wife and kid. And I used to make kind of freaky music at home. And you would hear it coming through on things like Tomorrow Never Knows on Revolver or Rain and some little backwards things, but I never made that the whole track. I would take the sort of most usable and add it to the Beatles, or to my tracks of the Beatles, or the Walrus, the Strawberries, or whatever, fiddle around a bit, or put loops, or, you know, something funny. But at home, I was really far out, and I had a kind of little studio, which was really just a lot of tape recorders, and we made Two Virgins that way. She came over for a date, as it were, and I didn't know what to do, and she didn't know what to do. I said, you know, I didn't know what to do with her, so I said, you want to go upstairs and play with the tapes? You know? So, because we didn't know what to do, we did play with the tapes all night. And we made Two Virgins, and I was showing her all my different tape recordings and how I made the funny sound. I was running around pushing buttons and playing the Mellotron, and she started into the Yoko Ono stuff, which is now stuff you hear on B-52s or Lenny Lovitz and all that stuff. She started doing this, and all that, and I thought, this is great. And I was going on the tapes, and she was going, and we made a tape all night, and in the morning we made love, and the sun came up. But we'd made this album's worth of sound together without consciously setting out to make something. That was the first togetherness. And we shot the cover ourselves privately, and it wasn't, you know, we just got somebody to set the camera up, took the shot, and put out Two Virgins. That was the start of the whole shebang. What are they doing? This Japanese witch has made him crazy, and he's gone bananas. But all she did was take the bananas part of me out of the closet more, you know, that had been inhibited by the other part. It was a complete relief to meet somebody else who was as far out as I was, you know. That was the real thing. Well, now we'd like to have a commercial success, but when we made Two Virgins, we weren't worried about commercial. We just wanted to put out a statement of where it was at. You know, we wanted to share the thing. Some people accepted it, and a lot of people didn't, but the thing had an effect. That the fact that, you know, an Elvis Presley would take his clothes off and expose. Now, we had other shots for that cover, which made us look a lot more sexy and attractive. Believe me, you know. True. You know, if you pose a certain way and you just do it like
it's
this.
Better.
And there were a couple more shots that later came out in the calendar with the Live Piece in Toronto album, where we look a little more attractive as a couple in a star kind of way. But we deliberately chose the one where we were standing there, you know, in all our glory, like a little flab around the waist, the legs a little, you know, nothing pretty about it. We wanted to say, we met, we're in love, we want to share it. Mm. And it was a kind of statement as well of of an awakening for me, too, you know. This Beatle thing that you've heard all about, this is how I am, really. You know, this is me naked with the woman I love. You want to share it? And people did and people didn't, but now you can't get it for $200, two virgins, right? So that's the way it goes.
As John and Yoko worked together, loved together, and eventually married, the influence of their individual artistic abilities began to meld. Yoko got more into music. John experimented with film and painting. Overtones of politics became more recognizable in their works. As the turbulent 60s became more uncertain, themes such as Give Peace a Chance became national anthems for Vietnam protesters. Recorded during their first bed-in in 1969 in a hotel room in Montreal, John and Yoko were determined to focus attention on themselves and thus on making love rather than war. It was also the debut record for the Plastic Ono Band. Here, John and Yoko discuss the interrelation of art, politics, communication, and love as it applied to those turbulent years.
Some of the ideas that she wanted both of us to do then, I must say I was more square then than I am now in a way, that I wish we'd done because now other people have done them because they... And I would say, no, I'm not going to do it. Are you kidding? I'm not doing that. You know, I would start reserving, you know. I don't want to do that, you know. We're in enough trouble as it is, you know. Let's not do that. That was banned, Woman Is in the Nigger World, because of the word nigger. Now, I had Ebony and Jet both say they are not offended, and we went down there with Dick Gregory, and just in case there were any questions there. And the statement, Woman Is the Nigger of the World, was made by Yoko in 1967 or 8 to an English woman's magazine called Nova, which was a kind of Vogue. And she was on the cover, and the title was Woman Is the Nigger of the World. I immediately stole the title and wrote a song. It didn't come out till 71. And there was all this hullabaloo about the word nigger, but the hullabaloo was from the white community, you know, not from the black community. Schoenberg and Weyburn, she'd studied at Sarah Lawrence and all that. I didn't know any of that stuff, and she was turning me on to her. Even Bertolt Brecht. I knew when we did Sometime in New York City, to me we were doing a newspaper. So one would rush it out into print, you see. So there was mistakes, say a little harmony wasn't perfect. We didn't go back and perfect every note. We just printed it out, you know, and sometimes there's words missing or something like that. And it was later that she said, well, you know what we did there? I said, no, we got into a lot of trouble, that's all I know. And, you know, the harmony's funny or something, yeah? Because we had her idea again. She had Chairman Mao and Richard Nixon dancing naked on the cover. It wasn't really their bodies. We just stuck their heads on. Well, the record company stuck a label on it in the supermarkets, and you couldn't even get it off when you went home, you know. And there was no genitals, nothing on it. But anyway, she... And I started getting down about that record thing. It was a mistake. We even though we tried to say something about women, we tried to say something about love and peace or whatever, the war... That, you know, we got into so much trouble. So she then took me to see Richard Foreman's production of the Threepenny Opera of Bertolt Brecht, which I don't know when it was originally out, in the 20s or the 30s. I said, oh, I see, so we're not alone, you know. I don't know what happened to Brecht when he first put that out, but it was the same idea, meaning, you know, to make a statement on the society right now, right away, and don't, no BS. Just say it, you know, I think this is wrong, that's right, this is my opinion. Communicate is the thing. It's that need to communicate. Politics was in the air those days. Come on, I mean, you know, you couldn't avoid it, right? And being artists, when we get into something, we get into it. You know what I mean? We wanted to be right there, down on the front lines. You know, but as we always said to everybody, with flowers, but still right down there. You know, we want to go all the way with it. And I think we did go all the way with it too. You know, our intentions were good. Not only the fact that we got together and boom, it was like an explosion, but there was also the Beatle thing about us getting together and whether they split because of us or not, or whatever the reason, all that stuff. The Beatles were splitting, the Beatles were arguing, John and Yoko was getting together, the anti-Vietnam crusades were going on all over, and we were involved in so many things, and we were putting out so much work, and we were making movies, making public appearances, performing at shows and all, traveling the world and doing all that. There was no time to reflect. There was only time to put out immediate impressions of what was happening. That's why I referred to the word is love on Rubber Soul. Straight to through to all you need is love, to give peace a chance, to imagine there's no countries, imagine no war, in other words. to write to this moment now. This album doesn't say imagine the whole world like that, because I've said that in a way. What I'm saying now is, now let's put the spotlight on the two of us and show how we're trying to imagine there's no wars, to live that love and peace, rather than sing about it only. Give peace a chance. Imagine is the same thing. You hit it right in the head. It's just imagine if there were no countries. Not no places where we each had our little spot. But imagine there was a time, you know, when you didn't have to have a passport to go from country to country. What kind of world are we creating? Really, it used to be you could go around, you know. What is this game that you can't get, that somehow this is America and then just across the field is Canada, and that you have to have all kinds of papers and pictures and stamps and passports? And the concept of imagining no countries, imagining no religion, not imagining no God, although you're entitled to do that too, imagining no denominations, imagining that we revere Jesus Christ, Mohammed, Krishna, Milarepa equally. We don't have to worship either one, that we don't have to, but imagine there's no Catholic, Protestant,